Hello, folks, and welcome to the Illinois World Labor Hour this Saturday, October 18, 2008. Brought to you on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign and webcasting at www.weft.org, community radio for East Central Illinois and the world. The views of the white opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. I'm your host, David Johnson, here with co-host Tom Thomas with Labor News and the Labor Hour Cultural Center Corner, and our technical advisor, Bob Plesney, with more Labor News. Tom's brand new poem for this week, first heard here on the Illinois World Labor Hour, will be Worker, Seize Your Prize.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Yes, I'd like to comment. I just found out this morning that the Champaign County AFL-CIO endorsed three members of the Green Party for county board candidates. This is unprecedented. Two of the three are union members. One's a member of the IEA Teachers Union supports. Actually, I'm sorry, for the Academic Professionals, and that's Joe Frutell. And the other union member is Mike Lehman, who is a GEO member and grievance officer. And the third candidate is Walter Patuk, who is a student at the U of I. So I want to congratulate the AFL-CIO of Champaign County for doing the right thing to actually supporting union members running for office, regardless if they're Democrats or not. Also, the Illinois World Labor Hours is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalition amongst union workers and the community, the IEA and JWJ are proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
According to recent reports, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation has limited, if any, access to funding for its mortgage and auto lending units. Al De Molina, GMAC's chief executive, has said GMAC may trim auto lending in some international markets and is considering strategic initiatives for the insurance businesses. GMAC, which is based in Detroit, Michigan, has begun to restrict auto lending to buyers with credit scores of 700 or higher, representing only 58% of U.S. consumers. Plummeting auto sales and record foreclosures have resulted in $5.4 billion in losses at GMAC over the past year, and has led credit agencies to classify the debt as junk. Cerberus Capital Management, which bought 51% of the lender from GM in 2006, may evaluate and attempt new and creative solutions to the problems brought about by the political and environmental situations, according to Mr. De Molina. GMAC still provided some 43% of GM's second quarter auto loans. This from San Francisco. The electric car company Tesla Motors said it would lay off employees and delay production of its second car, the Model S. Tesla also removed its chief executive and appointed Elon Musk, the company's chairman and principal investor, to the position. Mr. Musk posted the changes on Tesla's website, saying the company was in a critical phase but should have a positive cash flow in another 9 months. Musk blamed worsening financial problems as a result of our national credit crisis for the upheaval. Tesla, the poster child for California's push into clean technology, has had a particularly difficult year with previous layoffs, executive turnover, and production delays for its first car, a $109,000 all-electric roadster, as well as the Model S sedan. The Model S, which is intended to travel 200 miles on a single charge of its lithium-ion battery, is expected to sell for around $80,000. Its introduction will now be delayed from 2010 to mid-2011. 6 months after General Motors is expected to offer its electric car, the Chevrolet Volt. Last week, the Coca-Cola Corporation reported a better-than-expected quarterly profit as strong international demand offset the falling volume of consumption at home. Coca-Cola said net income for the third quarter of 2008, which ended on September 26th, rose to $1.89 billion, or 81 cents per share, up from the $1.65 billion, or 71 cents per share, it had registered a year earlier. According to Reuters estimates, the company itself earned 83 cents per share, topping the analyst average forecast of 77 cents. Coca-Cola's revenues rose so far in 2008 to some $8.39 billion as sales by volume increased 5%. Volume sales fell by more than 2% in North America, but actually rose 7% internationally. Coke, which is based in Atlanta, Georgia, is claiming it is on track for its production initiatives to deliver $400 to $500 million in annual savings by the end of 2011. The results from Coke come immediately after its biggest competitor, the Pepsi Corporation, posted a lower-than-expected quarterly profit on weak beverage sales, which is cutting into its full year's outlook. Tens of thousands of Mexicans who labored in the United States under a World War II-era guest worker program will be eligible to collect back pay under a settlement to a long-fought lawsuit. From 200,000 to 300,000 laborers, called braceros, worked as farmhands or railroad workers from 1942 to 1946. And under the program, a portion of their pay was deducted and transferred to the Mexican government, allegedly to be returned to the workers when they returned to Mexico. However, many of the laborers have said they never received that pay, and many never even knew that 10% of their salaries had been deducted. In 2001, lawyers filed a class action lawsuit in California. The suit was dismissed twice as courts considered whether too much time had passed and whether a lawsuit against the Mexican government could have standing in the United States. Scores of elderly ex-braceros staged protests across Mexico demanding their compensation, and the courts of both nations began to pay attention. Last Wednesday, lawyers for the braceros and representatives of the Mexican government and the Federal District Court in San Francisco gave preliminary approval to a settlement in the case. Under that settlement, which is scheduled for a hearing on final approval within a few months, Mexico will pay each bracero or their individual direct heir some $3,500. Dave?
Okay, this is a little piece of international news here. Die Linke, the German left party, its regional conference in Hesse over the weekend voted overwhelmingly for a resolution for the Frankfurt City Federation of the party for the nationalization of all banks and remaining financial sectors under democratic control so they can be used to guide the economy and interests of the people. In a second resolution, the party voted to tolerate a new minority SPD green regional government but demanded an anti-poverty program and no cuts in social services. This represents a strong regional move to the left compared to previously anemic slogans of the Linke about better controls. In Lower Saxony, too, the Linke has been discussing perspectives and program. Representatives of the six main factions inside the Linke met twice at the end of September to debate the way forward. One participant carried the 100-point political program of the Linke to Allende's government program in Chile and said it would cause a similar reaction if a left government tried to implement it. The planned privatization of the German railways has now been canceled owing to the impossibility of raising enough private capital at the moment. And now we go to Workers Independent News.
For registrations, Acorn itself is not falsifying voter registrations as portrayed by John McCain's campaign and some corporate media reports. Acorn's Austin King says the vast majority of Acorn's 1.3 million new voter registrations are legitimate and will give low-income voters a real voice.
This was a phenomenal effort that has made our voter rolls look more like America, and because of that, the electorate that shows up on November 4th will look more like America. And when more low-income people participate, we get more power.
GM announced on Thursday it plans to cut 1,500 more jobs, 400 in Delaware, 700 in Michigan. The three plants being targeted for those cuts produce large sedans and pickups. The automobile industry saw its sharpest decline in 17 years during September as sales plummeted 27%. Dr. James Parrott of New York's Fiscal Policy Institute says that a new study by the Center for Economic Policy Research reveals that median wages for young U.S. workers today are lower than 30 years ago. Unions, Parrott says, raise those wages by an average of 13%.
Unions make an important difference in the compensation and the pay and benefits that young workers receive. And that could, you know, that could be one of the reasons why young workers, young people generally, are so anxious for significant economic change in this country, because they see that their living standards have been held back by the kind of policies that we've had.
New York City workers whose jobs depend on the health of the financial sector could be looking at hard times. Jesse Russell reports.
New York City Comptroller William Thompson had a dire projection for employment over the next 2 years. Thompson estimates that 165,000 jobs could be lost in the city due to problems in the financial markets. 35,000 of those jobs could come directly from the financial sector. New York City is the heart of the country's financial industry. And as banks file for bankruptcy or are bought out, jobs are expected to be lost. The losses brought on by the financial crisis are being reflected in decisions by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He recently asked city agencies to slash spending by 2.5% this fiscal year. Here is today's economic report. There are many ways to measure the health of the local economy. One way is to count the number of vacancies in your local mall. According to a report from real estate research firm Reese, vacancies at malls are up 6.6% this year. That's the largest increase since 2002. Strip malls and open-air shopping centers aren't faring any better, with vacancies at 8.4%. For those type of malls, that's the highest rate since 1994.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And right now it's time to take out the jams! Kick out the jam! Yes! Kick out the jam! Kick them out! Yes, I'm starting to sweat. You know my shirt's all wet. What I'm feeling. It's the sound that I bounce and rebound and rebound off the ceiling. You gotta have it, baby. You can't do it without it. When you get the feeling, you got it. Sign them all up with that mic in my hand. And let me kick out the jam. Yes, kick out the jam. I have to kick out.
Okay, folks, that was the MC5 playing Kick Out the Jams. And This segment of the Illinois Labor Hour, or the show today, we're going to be talking a little bit about this period in Detroit era during the late 60s, early 70s. MC5 was part of it. A lot of people out of the working class backgrounds were doing all sorts of musical and political things, and so we're going to be talking about that. Part of the Inspirationist program is fellow worker co-host Bill Gorell from the Illinois Labor Hour, the first time I ever heard of the MC5, and Wayne Kramer, who was one of the members of the MC5, was through Bill Gorell. And also John Sinclair, who was the first manager of the MC5, and that was only one of many things that he was involved in, spoke here at the U of I Thursday night, and Bob and I went and saw him. So, anyway, we're going to be playing a little bit of stuff from John Sinclair himself. He's also a poet and a musician. Bob, so tell me a little bit about what you've, sort of some of your research and stuff as far as John Sinclair.
Well,
And the MC5, too, I guess, because okay. They interconnect.
We got an email earlier in the week, and a person described John Sinclair, said he was a poet, performing artist and band leader, music journalist, radio broadcaster, record producer, educator, and archivist, 1960s cultural activist, founder of the Detroit Artists Workshop, manager of the MC5, and chairman of the White Panther Party.
That's quite a tall order for one person.
Yes, he's done a lot of different things. I believe he now lives in Amsterdam, and I think he does a weekly radio show from there on Radio Free Amsterdam.
Oh, that sounds good.
I think you can find it on the internet if you want to look. And
okay.
He still plays.
Is it done in English?
Yes.
Yeah.
He still plays some MC5 songs on there on occasion, and some early rock and roll stuff, Rolling Stones and things mm-hmm. like that, you know.
Okay. Yeah, what I have here is that John Sinclair was born in 1941 in Detroit, and one time manager of the MC5 and leader of the White Panther Party, which was a militant anti-racist countercultural political group of white left-wing people from working class backgrounds seeking to assist the Black Panthers in the civil rights movement and political change in the United States from November 1968 to July 69 was when it was formed. Sinclair was involved in the reorganization of the Detroit underground newspaper Fifth Estate during the paper's growth in the late 60s. Fifth Estate continues to publish to this day, making it one of the longest continuously published alternative periodicals in the United States. Sinclair also contributed to the formation of Detroit Artist Workshop Press, which published 5 issues of Work magazine. Sinclair managed the hard-edge proto-punk MC5 from 1966 through 1969. Under his guidance, the band embraced the countercultural revolutionary politics of the White Panther Party. During this period, Sinclair booked the Five as the regular house band at Detroit's famed Grand Ballroom in what came to be known as the Kick Out the Jam Show. He was managing the MC5 at the time of the free concert outside the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, which, by the way, I doing a little research, I found there's 2 films, I guess, that has a lot of archive film footage, and one of them is them playing at the Chicago Democratic Convention.
I think they were the only band that played that day.
Well,
they were saying that there was a bunch of other artists that were supposed to show up. Only Neil Young ever got there, and he didn't perform. And I believe I read that the MC5 played for like 8 hours that day. They just kept playing and playing. So,
well, it says here that the band was the only group, as you said, to perform before baton-wielding police broke up the massive anti-Vietnam War rally. And eventually the MC5 came to find Sinclair's. Well, anyway, they had a little breaking up over politics and stuff. But I saw a film clip of that MC5 performance, a very brief one at the Democratic National Convention. And really, what's really interesting is this band, they described it as a proto, quote unquote, proto punk band. Yeah. I mean, considering this was 1968, I mean, when they came on, I mean, they just like jumped up in the air. And I mean, it's real high energy. Reminds you like some of the early Who.
Right. I think theatrics. The Who was part of their inspiration.
Okay.
But they had 2 guitarists in the MC5, and mm-hmm. they liked to really kick out the jams,
yeah,
as they say,
yeah.
You know.
But it was interesting because their music was, I mean, of course, you listen to this Kick Out the Jams. I mean, this was, it had a lot of the influence of the music at the time as far as the heavy rock and everything. But there was definitely this, and of course, no one recognized it at the time, but this seemed to been like some of the initial nebulous, if you will, formation of the later punk music scene.
Right.
Which I thought was fascinating in the sense that, I mean, before anyone could categorize it, they kind of came up with the sound that later, what was his name? Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
And some other bands started forming. Then later, well, of course,
Iggy Pop played with the Stooges, and the mm-hmm. Stooges are another Detroit band, I think.
They're out of Detroit, too.
I believe they were active at the same time. In fact, they were friends, I believe, with the MC5. Some of those guys were kind of...
Okay, that explains a few things.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
See, like, there's a lot happening in Detroit this period in the late 60s. To go on about John Sinclair, though, after a series of conviction for possession of marijuana, Sinclair was sentenced to 10 years in prison in 1969 after giving two joints of marijuana to an undercover narcotics officer. 10 years. The sentence sparked the landmark Free John Now rally at Ann Arbor's Chrysler Arena in December 1971. The event brought together a who's who of left-wing and political luminaries, including pop musicians John Lennon, Yoko Ono, Stevie Wonder, Phil Ox, Bob Seger, jazz artist Archie Shepp, and Roswell Rudd, and speakers Allen Ginsberg, Rennie Davis, David Dellinger, Jerry Rubin, and Bobby Seale. 3 days after the rally, Sinclair was released from prison when the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that the state's marijuana statutes were unconstitutional. I mean, this is quite interesting.
Yeah, I think John Sinclair's road manager said the other evening that John Lennon wrote a song about John Sinclair.
Yes, and he mentioned that it was like only one of a few that...
two or three songs that John Lennon had ever written about a person.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, Bob and I went over Thursday night to see John Sinclair. Anyway, Bob, you want to talk a little bit about that guy? I mean, I don't want to get too off the track here.
Right.
But
I did want to mention a couple of things about the White Panther Party and the 10-point program that they
sure.
had there.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
One is full endorsement and support of the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. But they wanted to have a free exchange of energy and materials. They demand an end of money. They wanted free clothes, food, housing, dope, music, bodies, medical care, everything free for everybody. They wanted free access to information media, free the technology from the greed creeps. They wanted free time and space for all humans, dissolve all unnatural boundaries, free all schools and all structures from corporate rule, turn the buildings over to the people at once, free all prisoners everywhere, they are our brothers, free all soldiers at once, no more conscripted armies. And free the people from their leaders. Leaders suck. All power to all the people. Freedom means free everyone. So
that was definitely circa 1968.
Yes,
for sure.
It was.
But what's interesting is some of those things in there, I mean, are as relevant
still
today.
Still apply today, yes.
Indeed.
Exactly.
Well, there were some other things going on in Detroit at this time, of course. There was, of course, in this period, all over the country, there was racial strife. And Detroit was no exception for being a large city. But a lot of working class and union stuff was going on, and it sort of intersected music, other social things like marijuana decriminalization. But also there was another interesting little thing that was happening within the labor movement, the official labor movement, if you will, at this time, and that was the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM, its acronym. It was an organization of African-American workers formed in May of 1968 in the Chrysler Corporation's Hamtramck assembly plant, formerly Dodge, Maine, Detroit, Michigan. And Detroit labor activist Martin Globerman estimated at the time that the Harrimark plant was 70% black, while the union local, UAW Local 3, the plant management and lower supervision at the Hamtramck city administration was dominated by older white workers. DRUM sought to organize black workers to obtain concessions not only from the Chrysler management, but also from the United Auto Workers. Walter Reuther, the senior leadership who came out of the formation of the UAW back in the 30s with the sit-down strikes, and had been early supporter of the civil rights movement. Yet, in spite of their growing presence in the auto industry, African Americans rarely rose to positions of leadership within the union. In July of 68, DRUM led a wildcat strike against conditions at Hamtramck plant. The strike was observed by some 4,000 workers. It lasted 2.5 days and prevented the production of 3,000 cars. In the subsequent Local 3 election, DRUM ran an alternative slate. Although it did not win, the new organization drew notice for its militancy and willingness to challenge the UAW hierarchy. and the Revolutionary Union Movement foreign organization spread to other Detroit plants, including FRUM, which was the Ford Revolutionary Union Movement at the Ford River Rouge plant, and ELRUM, Eldon Avenue Revolutionary Union Movement at the Chrysler Eldon Avenue plant. These organizations were brought together in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which formed in June of 69. So this was all going on just in the Detroit area at the time. So quite an interesting period. And, of course, we'll come back and talk a little bit about this more. But first, with no further ado, we have the poem of the week. Tom Thomas with Worker, Seize Your Prize.
Time marches with a heavy step across a world cringed in fear, a world that has suffered hard and wonders if the end is near. For more than half a century, this poet has observed the earth and wrote the words that told the truth and questioned all our leaders' worth. We have not had a leader true here in the present century, since fecal fascist Nazi scum decided we should not be free. There are they who truly believe that masters they were meant to be, and that we simple working folk just do not deserve to be free. We don't deserve the palaces, although we workers built them all, because our masters are a class who truly don't expect to fall. But more people open their eyes when they are bombarded with lies, and perhaps we'll finally rise and stand until we seize our prize. The prize of true equality for all we working folk to see, and exercising enmity against our land's true enemy. Illuminati, they are called, but they shine not a ray of light. They should be driven from our land before we're stifled by their blight. Written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on October 16, 2008, Worker, Seize Your Prize was first recited live October 18, 2008 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, we have quite a few public service announcements today. Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, regular columnist of The Nation and The Guardian, and syndicated columnist of The New York Times, will be here in Champaign-Urbana Wednesday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Auditorium of Smith Memorial Hall at 805 South Matthews Avenue. That's the Smith Music Building on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her speech is The Rise of Disaster Capitalism in Latin America. Naomi Klein will outline a provocative interpretation of how the neoliberal project in Latin America was imposed, starting with the Pinochet regime in Chile and conceived as in the first laboratory of the ideas of Milton Friedman and Chicago Boys. She then discusses Argentina and the impact of the Falklands War on economic policies, as well as Bolivia's meltdown in the 1980s. Klein's argument will show how military coups and neoliberal ideologues in these countries guided the path for the imposition of a new economic model. And of course, Naomi Klein will be talking about a lot of other, in her latest book, Shock Doctrine. She'll be talking, besides military coups in Latin America, she's going to be talking about things like the tsunami, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and also say this latest financial bailout. This is all fits into her analysis of how the ruling elites use the shock in order to push through their agenda. Also, the Urbana-Champaign Books to Prisoners provides free books to inmates in Illinois prisons, as well as a lending library at the two Champaign County jails. As of 1994, all prisons throughout our state of Illinois have been under budget constraints and cuts, and this has affected all the educational programs in the libraries in the prison. As of today, October 17, 2008, we have sent 28,000 books to 4,300 different inmates in our 4 years of operation. Solely with volunteers. We think you will agree with us that education through reading is a good thing for prisoners returning to our communities from jail or prison. In order to skip the donated books to the prison, we have a book sale twice a year. It's called Pages for Pennies, because you can buy any hardback book for $1 and paperbacks for 50 cents. Please stop by and see for yourself at the Urbana Post Office, 202 South Broadway in Urbana, on Saturday, 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., and on Sunday from 11 to 1 p.m. Please come to our Books to Prisoners book sale on October 18th and 19th. Also, I got this in the email this week. a group of people are coming together to host a People's Thanksgiving Sunday evening, November 30th, at their Urbana Civic Center. We are inviting others to join our committee, and if you're interested, in, please respond to this email. You can contact Helena Worthen at the Labor Industrial Relations Institute, and you can reach her at 244-4095. That's 244-4095. If you're interested in working on a People's Thanksgiving on November 30th. Also, we've got there's a referendum coming up on the November ballot. The Champaign Community Union School District number 4, as well as other other school districts in the county, are facing the challenges of repairing and replacing aging facilities, meeting requirements of a federal consent decree, and providing equity and excellence for all schools. Tax caps and recently reduced state funding limit the district's ability to generate revenue. And recent legislation has provided relief through a voter-approved increase in the county sales tax to be used for school facilities. The 1% sales tax referendum proposed for November 4th will provide for additional funding for facilities for all Champaign school districts as well as others in the county, and it's an opportunity to, for property tax relief. So this public service announcement is in regard to advocating to vote yes on the sales tax referendum for this various Unit 4, well, in this case, Champaign, for Unit 4 schools. And last but not least, we have an event coming up here this afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. It's Grandpa's Goat, the band with Jim Iman, who's our local labor musician troubadour. That's his band, Jim, and his co-musicians Randy McCabe on guitar and mandolin, and Pamela Carsey on violin, fiddle, and they're going to be playing today at the Champaign Park District Prairie Farms Park, which is the petting zoo, and it's on West Kirby Avenue, right near Crescent Drive, and they'll be Grandpa's Goat will be playing from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Folks, that was another track from the MC5. Actually, you heard two of them there, and you had Motor City is Burning. It was the first track, and the other one, this last one, was American Ruse. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about those two songs as far as the lyrics?
Well, Motor City Burning, the lead singer, praises the role of the Black Panther snipers during the Detroit insurrection in 1967. And the second one, American Ruse, is, like you say, these guys were early punk performers, and they were talking a lot about freedom and how they were sick and tired of some of the misconceptions that the American people put on, media puts on the people here and stuff. So,
oh well, that's just as relevant today as it was back in 1968, of course.
It sure is.
Yeah,
sure is.
And we're going to be playing some a few things from John Sinclair too here a little bit towards the end of the program, but I wanted to mention, I was going to mention this, I got kind of sidetracked, is that our co-host and fellow worker Bill Gorell has a pretty lengthy interview with about this Dodge Revolutionary Union movement. He interviews this General Baker, who was General's actually his real first name. He interviewed him, and he's got it on archive somewhere, so we'll play that sometime on the show. And if I remember correctly, Bill used to play that on the anniversary of the Wildcat strike on basically around July 8th, 1968. So I just thought I'd give credit to Bill Gorell on that.
And Tom did a little news story earlier about GMAC and their financing,
right,
and they're having trouble and stuff like that. And in the news this week has been some talks evidently going on between that Cerberus, who owns Chrysler,
yeah,
and GM about maybe merging the two companies.
Uh-huh.
And I have a story here that the unions and the workers are uneasy at the possible GM and Chrysler deal. And Ron,
of the largest automakers.
Yes, yes. Well, two of the big three, two of the three remaining American automakers.
Yeah.
United Auto Workers President Ron Gittelfinger said the union had not had any official discussions with any of the parties involved in a potential merger, which he said remained speculation, but he said the United Auto Workers wanted to protect jobs. They say that a merger between GM and Chrysler would almost certainly prompt job cuts, plant shutdowns, and the elimination of models and dealerships, analysts say. Concern over the talks was also evident among workers at three auto plants in the Detroit suburb of Warren, one belonging to GM and two belonging to Chrysler. "I barely have any work as it is," says Stephen Jackson, a worker at the GM engine plant there. So, yes, I'm worried about job security. At one of the Chrysler plants here, the company's Dodge Ram and Dodge Dakota pickup trucks are assembled, and workers' concerns at this plant said they feared their trucks would be eliminated post-merger in favor of those made by GM. "GM's got a truck just like Chrysler has," says William Willis, a contractor at Chrysler's Warren Truck Plant, which makes Dodge Ram and Dodge Dakota pickup trucks. "If there's a merger, then one of these trucks has got to go. That's what everyone in this plant is concerned about." And between them, GM and Chrysler employ about 205,000 workers in America and produce 12 million cars annually.
Wow. So. Well, let's see what happens on that. But anyway, so Bob and I, we went Thursday night over to see John Sinclair at the architecture building. And, it turns out that John Sinclair actually only spoke very briefly. And the main point of the...
For about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
He basically just introduced the other gentleman that was speaking there that night.
Yes, and a guy named Dana Beal.
Right. And then John did recite a poem, about a two-minute poem.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. It wasn't what we expected, you know, going there. But I guess this guy, Dana Beal, used to be a comrade of John Sinclair's back in the late 60s up in Detroit.
In the White Panther Party,
yes.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Dana Beal formed or was one of the instigators in creating the Yippies.
That's right.
And the Youth International Party.
Yes, with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and all those notorious revolutionaries out there during this time period. And if I remember correctly, Dana was saying that he was there at the stock exchange when the Yippies went up into the balcony.
Threw out their dollar bills.
And threw out a whole... armfuls of dollar bills,
the traders were trading millions of dollars, but they stopped trading to go get the dollar bills that were falling down.
Yes, so hence they shut down the trading stocks exchange for a good 15-20 minutes. This was interesting. I mean, I was very, very young at the time this was going on, but I remember this. Tom, you're a little older than Bob and I, and you probably remember more about a lot of the Yippies' activities.
I don't have a vivid memory of it, but I do remember the incident and when it happened and how it happened, and how I enjoyed watching it happen.
Yeah, this was a very interesting period of time. I mean, unlike now, the economy was really, really strong at that time. There was very, very low unemployment. People had good. I mean, most people had good paying jobs, benefits. One wage earner in a family was very common, unlike today again. But it was still a period of social strife. I mean, you had the civil rights movement, you had the Vietnam War, and there was a lot of. It was a very revolutionary period in the society. Which what made it unique was that usually revolutionary and cultural, whether it's cultural, political, economic revolutions, usually occur in times of economic downturn. And what happened back in the 1930s during the Great Depression, but this was not the case. So it's just it's kind of interesting little historical, and it's funny too because a lot of the things that they advocated then, 68, could be just as easily advocated today.
Yeah.
Anyway, this Dana Beal, real quickly, he evidently was arrested. I don't know how long ago was it he was arrested.
June, I believe.
In June, okay. Yeah. Because he stopped in Mattoon. He had a couple of companions in the car, and the police found $150,000 in cash.
Right.
And what I didn't know was that it's illegal to have over a certain amount of cash your person.
That's what he was saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking to some other people, and yes, this is confirmed that they automatically charge you with the money laundering.
Money laundering, right.
Just for having over a certain amount of cash on your person. However, it did turn out shortly after he was arrested, the Supreme Court overturned that charge. And so, therefore, they couldn't charge him with money laundering. And instead, they're charging him with 5 counts of obstruction of justice because he wouldn't cooperate with the police and telling them about the money. It turns out he was going to Mexico, heading to actually New Mexico and then eventually heading to across the border into actual the country of Mexico to open a, an Ibogaine clinic with the money that he'd gotten from people. Now, this brings up a whole new topic. I'd never heard of Ibogaine.
Me neither.
And Ibogaine turns out it's a derivative, it's a hallucinogenic drug, actually, that comes from the root of a bush that grows in Africa, and like local people in Africa, in mainly West Africa and Central Africa, have been using this for centuries as part of their religious rituals.
Religious, yeah.
But what's interesting about Ibogaine is that there's all sorts of studies that show that it cures all sorts of addictions. Right. I mean, cures.
Yes.
Everything from heroin, methamphetamines, even alcohol and nicotine. And it showed, you know, that he gave a really interesting presentation on this, and you know, had all these cited all these studies that were done and
right.
who did them, and
very in depth into the chemistry behind it and everything. Mm-hmm. I was surprised how in depth he went into that.
Well, this is what's interesting, I think, is the fact that first of all, I mean, two issues here that kind of really got me going, Will, is the fact of that the powers that the police have these days is just. I mean, it's totally out of control.
It's scary.
Indeed. I mean, you know, the citizens need to start taking back some control here, and the police need to start abiding by the Constitution and respecting the citizens' rights. I mean, I'm not saying anything about the police. Of course, we need the police to keep, you know, peace in the society. But you know what? Things have gone way, way too far here, and we're starting to head towards a police state if we're not careful. That's the one thing. The other thing is about Ibogaine. It seems like, and according to, I mean, first of all, I never heard about it. Bob never heard about it. Tom's never heard about it. And it's interesting is that it seems like there is a concerted effort by the powers that be to keep information about Ibogaine away from the general public.
I wonder if one of those powers that be could be the AMA.
Well, I don't know about so much AMA, but I could bet you the pharmaceutical companies would be maybe one. But more importantly, I think more than the pharmaceutical companies, because frankly, technically, they could get in on the action if they wanted to. But, you know, there's a whole industry related around the drug war. I mean, that's one thing. We've talked about this before on the Labor Hour. I mean, everything from, you know, it's called the nicknamed the prison industrial complex, like the military industrial complex, in the sense that you got this whole industry out there. Everything from DEA and you know drug various you know local police departments have drug squads who get tons of overtime and employment. You have various prisons that it's really sad. A lot of these small communities have lost some of their industry and stuff. Have become getting prisons to replace some of the industry that they lost before. Prisons and incarceration is one of the largest. It's a huge segment of the employing industry in this country.
I believe Champaign and Urbana ship some of their prisoners out to small communities in the area.
Yes, indeed. I worked on
housed overnight.
Indeed, and they get paid. The local jails get paid a certain amount of money per prisoner per day.
They basically built some of these jails in small communities just for that reason.
Well, I worked on a jail like you're describing in Monticello.
Yeah.
Before this was built, the Monticello jail was this old turn of the century stone brick building. It looked like they had maybe four jail cells in it. It looked like something maybe from Andy of Mayberry.
Yeah.
This place they built that I worked on for a while. It was huge. It was like over, I believe, 50 cells.
Yeah.
And it was like a small little mini prison with a central pod, guard pod, and everything. It's like, my question was, what the heck is Monticello doing with a jail this size? And they said, well, it's going to be a big money maker for them,
yeah.
for the county.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're coming to. And the thing is that, not to mention the economic interests that could be devastated if there was actually a product that came out that would cure. Drug addiction. I mean, war on drugs would be pretty much severely crippled, if not over, that was the case.
One of the things about this Ibogaine, they seem to claim that you could take it one time and you could be cured for the rest of your life from heroin, methadone, crack, speed, nicotine, alcohol. For about 33% of the people, about one third of the people, you take this drug one time. And you would be cured for life. You never had the desire to go back to any of these addictive things. And he got into the chemistry of how it rebuilt the synapses in your brain and everything. And you didn't need the dopamine and stuff like that after that. It was really interesting.
Yes, and it begs the question, of course, is why? How come we haven't heard about this? And it seems like there is an effort. And this is the only country in the world where Ibogaine is illegal. And it's actually classed as class 4 or whatever. Schedule 4, something like
something,
that. Basically, it's not drug. The Schedule 4 is like one the drug that has no medical use, and it's a high rate of for abuse. And heroin, it's right there with heroin. Anyway, it's just it was interesting. Even though we were disappointed that we didn't hear John Sinclair talk about the current political situation and stuff, I would like to hear some of his views on that. But anyway, we're going to go to play a little bit of John Sinclair here right now.
This is the Delta Sound.
Or drove up Highway 61 in a B-52. beat up Ford.
Okay, and Bob, you had something that you wanted to mention about John Sinclair?
Yeah, those were a couple songs from John Sinclair's CD, Fattening Frogs for Snakes. And he's also got a book of poetry, The Delta Sound Suite. And most of his more recent work, he has a backup band playing behind him, and he recites his poems to the band, and they're really blues-oriented. He's been a big fan of the blues lately. He was also instrumental in starting the Ann Arbor Jazz and Blues Festival up in Michigan, and he also did a lot of work down in New Orleans with the Jazz and Heritage Fest down there. But
this guy's just a man. He's just
he's been around for many years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, and Bob, and we're going to leave you with one last track of the MC5. Come Together. Thank you for tuning in to the Illinois World Labor Hour, broadcast from downtown Champaign on 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide at www.weft.org. And we'll see you next week.